are the Yes to Life show, a further exploration of the world of integrative medicine for cancer. A couple of weeks back, Yes to Life hosted a keynote seminar at CAM Expo, the show for complementary and alternative medicine practitioners and suppliers that takes place in Olympia each autumn. I presented two top speakers on lifestyle interventions for cancer, oncologist Professor Robert Thomas and nutritionist Liz Butler. The talks were excellent, and so I decided to broadcast them on the show to make them much more widely available. Good morning, everybody. Good to see you so bright and early. Hello, my name's Robin Daly, and I'm here to represent the charity Yes to Life. This is our keynote presentation today, and we've got two fantastic speakers for you on the subject of lifestyle and cancer. First of all, the advert break, just to say that we've got a stand here for Yes to Life, so do come down and take a look and talk to us. It's stand number 1904. Anybody who's not heard of Yes to Life, what we do is we help people with information about integrative medicine for cancer. We help people make up their mind what they want to do, give them some decent information, and then we help them to do their chosen course if they need some assistance. We've got a number of initiatives out at the moment. I have a radio show, which I'd like you all to listen to. I have fantastic guests on my radio show, like Liz and Professor Thomas. All my past shows are up there. You can thumb through them and listen to any of the past shows. And there's a new one out each week. It's on UK Health Radio. Just put the Yes to Life show into Google and you'll find us. We've got a book came out this year called The Cancer Revolution. It's on our stand. Do take a look at that. Of course, we've got plenty of presence on social media, so do tap into that if you want to find out what we're up to. We've got some great events happening this autumn. In terms of this particular event, we may have a couple of questions if there's time, but our aim is actually to take the Q&A elsewhere onto the stand afterwards. So both Liz Butler and Professor Thomas will be on the stand for as long as it's needed, up to an hour, to talk to people. So do come down and talk to them there if you've got a question, you don't get a chance to ask it here. So on to our first speaker, Professor Robert Thomas. He, as he'll tell you, he's a regular oncologist doing that regular stuff at Addenbrookes and Bedford hospitals, but he's got an abiding interest in lifestyle and cancer. He's got a website, CancerNet, which is dedicated to the subject. He's written a book on the subject, Lifestyle and Cancer, The Facts, and he is out there talking about this all the time. He also, with his own patients, he gives them a lifestyle consultation as well as everything else he does. So he's definitely severely interested in the much wider picture of cancer and treating cancer. So he's also chair of the Macmillan Exercise Expert Advisory Board and the Walking for Health Board, and he's headed up some very important trials of natural substances, some very heavyweight trials that have really put some natural substances on the map in terms of their credibility. So today he's going to tell us about the scientific evidence behind some of these approaches. And so I'd like you to give a big welcome to Professor Robert Thomas.
Thank you very much, Robin. Very complimentary introduction. I hope I can live up to those words. So yes, I've already said, I treat patients with chemotherapy, radiotherapy, hormone therapy, biological treatment, viruses soon. So don't boo too much. But I'm also very, very interested. The longer I become an oncologist, the more and more interested I am in the whole sort of holistic part of treating patients and how they can help themselves. And I think that's been very underestimated as part of mainstream oncology management over the last few years. So I'd like to just share with you some of the things we're doing in our unit to try and prove that these things work. And show some of the trials we've been doing. So unfortunately, most patients I see or come to me are very confused about the information they've been given off the internet or off colleagues or often off doctors, and most doctors are very confused as well. And that's why conferences like this are very important, and Yes for Life is, you know, gives very clear data to patients, but I think it's quite lacking. So we do try to involve lifestyle management as part of patients' mainstream strategies. But we've only got 20 minutes today, so I'm not going to be talking about, you know, the obvious things of exercise, giving up smoking, reducing alcohol. And we've got Liz talking about the psychological aspects later. And if you do want information from these, the Cancer Revolution book summarizes them quite succinctly. I think I did the exercise chapter in that as well, yeah. So I'm mainly just today going to be talking about some of the nutritional aspects. So first of all, one of the important things when you say to patients, too much of any food is bad. So if you become overweight because you're eating healthy food, you're still overweight. And 40 to 50% of patients after cancer treatment put on significant amounts of weight. They're often middle age, and they find it very difficult to lose it. And the problem is, I mean, and not only is it uncomfortable for them, but it's related to sort of poor wound healing and increased hot flushes, etc. But it's actually linked to a worse survival if you are overweight. Your cancers are more aggressive, and it's more likely to come back. And this is a nice study published in one of the world's best cancer journals called JCO, which showed if you put on weight during your chemotherapy, it's not just the being overweight, putting on weight is linked to a worse survival. So what are patients told during their chemotherapy? Don't worry about putting on weight, you'll lose it afterwards. So the advice they're given is directly contrary to the actual facts. So patients need to be told not to put on weight. And I know it's difficult, but you know that's the fact. So if they want to help themselves, don't put on weight during your chemotherapy. It is hard. Patients are fatigued, they're nauseated, they're not as active, so they comfort eat, they're given steroids. One of the best advice I find, I mean, everyone's got their own tricks. This is a nice study published in JAMA, one of the American journals, which showed if you fast overnight for 13 hours, not only has an anti-cancer effect, you have reduced glycosylated hemoglobin, which is markers of excess sugars, and it's a good way to lose weight, as well as having anti-cancer properties. And this study, which was over 2,500 people, showed that people who did fast overnight, or in other words, didn't eat from their evening meal to their breakfast, which is not massive hardship, actually had a 36% reduction in the risk of their breast cancer relapse. So it has anti-cancer properties. Bone density is a big problem amongst patients after cancer treatments, steroids, chemotherapy, premature menopause and things. And that can lead to fractures later in life, such as crush fractures of the spine. And if you break your hip, certainly in our hospital, and get admitted, you've got a high chance of not coming out because you've caught a superbug or something. So it's best not to fracture anything and get into a hospital. But also, if you have osteoporosis and you're not on a bisphosphonate, you have a higher chance of developing bone metastases as well, because the environment is more receptive for metastases. So what are patients told to do? They're told to take calcium and vitamin D supplements. Well, and most doctors say, I'm only evidence-based practice. I only do evidence-based practice. So they might have read the BMJ, Britain's most prestigious journal, an overview of 59 studies showing that calcium and vitamin D supplements have no impact on osteoporosis at all, yet they're dished out like Smarties. More worryingly, 15 randomized trials show that they actually increase the risk of heart attacks. So most patients are given tablets which don't work, which increase the risk of heart attacks. They're not told, generally, I mean, some GPs do, some don't, to eat plant-based protein products such as soya. In fact, they're told to avoid soya after breast cancer because there's this myth that increases relapse rate. Of course, two large studies shows it actually reduces relapse rate. So they're told advice directly contrary to improve their bone health, and obviously to get plenty of sun without sunburning. I do skin cancers now, so I don't want to have too much work, but sunbathing without sunburning increases your vitamin D, which also has effects on cancer as well. So, and we do sort of issue guidelines to patients how to increase their bone density and have calcium-based foods, which are not necessarily dairy, such as spinach and nuts and stuff like that. The other advice, which is confusing, because mainly dietitians, certainly where I work, aren't on board with the anti-sugar message. And they say there's no real evidence. Well, of course, there's no randomized evidence that sugar is harmful. You can't do a trial of 100 people in one room and 100 people in another room and give one sugar and not sugar and follow them for 20 years. But there's lots of circumstantial evidence. The nurses' health study and the health professionals' follow-up study was a combination of 100,000 people followed for 20 years. And there's a very clear correlation. If you have processed sugar and sugars with, foods with high glycemic index, you have a higher risk of cancer. We know that if you eat high glycemic foods or processed sugar, it puts your insulin levels up. Cancer cells have insulin receptors, so you're constantly riding at too high insulin levels, which leads to diabetes and growth factors such as insulin-like growth factors, which drives tumour cells to grow and metastasize. So yet most patients just carry on having sugar in the tea and coffee, and we make a big point of getting them to reduce their sugar intake. We have a blog and we have lots and lots of stories of, you know, what sugar is. Fruit is okay, but, you know, processed sugar isn't. I'm sure Robin emphasises that as well. So coming on to other carcinogens, I put sugar as a carcinogen. You could say, well, why talk about carcinogens if someone has cancer? They've already had the genetic mutation for the cells to start growing. But actually, we get cancers every day, but our immunity mops them up. For that, those cancer cells to grow fast, to develop new blood vessels, invade other organs and metastases, there's a whole load of other biological processes which take place, which involve these pathways. And they are dependent on your body's immunity and the further carcinogenic intake. So what carcinogens should you look out for? Well, acrolamines are the most common ones in our food source, and these are produced by superheating carbohydrates or sugar. So something like Pringle, which is mushed up carbohydrate with sugar added and baked to extremely high temperature, is a perfect food for generating carcinogens. And there's lots of others like rye bread and things like that, and burnt toast, etc. So we try to educate people to avoid these. And in our blog now we have actual recipes, because instead of just saying you need to avoid this, we actually give them examples. So puffed rice without sugar in, whole nuts, etc., organic soy milk, stuff like that. The other big carcinogen is nitrates, and the WHO recently did a warning about processed meat. I don't know if you're aware of that. Of course, they lumped processed meat into one big pool. They compared it to Spam, which you get from the corner shop for 15p a can, to very well produced sort of cured meats from Spain, which have been organically grown and full of healthy probiotics. But nevertheless, they are all rich in nitrates. But the actual carcinogen is nitrous amines, which is converted in the stomach. So that process can be blocked by eating vitamin C or antioxidant type foods, healthy foods. In fact, there's lots of nitrates in spinach, but it doesn't get converted to nitrous amines. The other main carcinogen we have is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. They're produced by superheating meat or burning meat. Burning also has smoke in it, which is also carcinogenic. But I like a lovely study from Maryland where they marinated meat in rosemary and other herbs before barbecuing it and measured the levels of PAHs in the bloodstream, and they were significantly lower if you marinated the meat. So in other words, the herbs and spices were acting as their own antidotes. And there's other guidelines which you can reduce these by cutting the fat, the burn off the meat, cleaning the griddle, cooking the meat before you put it on the barbecue. So we're not saying to people you can't go out and enjoy a barbecue in the summer, but there's ways to reduce your exposure by sensible cooking methods. So it's all about, we're not saying to patients you need to avoid everything, but you need to have the natural antidotes to go with the carcinogens, because we can't get rid of carcinogens completely in our diet. Just walking down the road, we would have breathed car fumes, etc. So what are the natural antidotes? I've already mentioned herbs and spices and things like that. Well, they're the phytochemicals. These are the things in food which give it the smell, the taste, and the colour usually. And you could call them the gifts from nature, because they have hundreds of other health properties as well. I'm sure many of the stands out there will have phytochemical-rich supplements or foods. And why they have anti-cancer properties? Well, I know the word antioxidants going out of fashion, but it's still actually quite important. We've already mentioned the rosemary study. So if you arm yourself with lots of these sort of foods, they do mop up the free radicals and prevent damage to the DNA, and they do arm the antioxidant enzymes such as superoxide dismutase, glutathione catalase, and things like that. So it's important to have these on board. Some of them have phytoestrogenic properties, and despite the name, phytoestrogenic lowers endogenous estrogen. Doesn't increase it. That's why soya-based products reduce the risk of breast cancer. They reduce chronic inflammation, which, as you know, if you have chronic inappropriately raised inflammation, that creates cytokines which drive tumour cells. Obviously, local inflammation or short-term inflammation is important to get rid of bacteria, but I'm talking about chronic long-term inflammation. And they have direct anti-cancer properties. These chemicals, these phytochemicals, and Liz and I wrote a review article on this, so if anyone wants to have a summary of the latest evidence, it's published in this journal, or it can be downloaded from our website. These chemicals added to cancer cells have direct anti-cancer properties. So there's lots of different mechanisms how they work. How do we get people to increase the level of phytochemicals or polyphenols in their diet? Well, there's lots of ways to do it. You can just eat a lot of them, which not a lot of people want to do. You can put it into a soup, which does damage some of them, but there's still a lot of phytochemicals in soup. You can. This is becoming a very good way, a way you sort of just grind up the whole fruit rather than juicing it. Obviously, avoid too many sweet things in there. Or you can put it in a whole food supplement. Now, obviously, as someone who has to design clinical trials and get them through ethics committees, you can't say, I'm doing a randomised trial of a plate of broccoli, because the ethics committee would say, well, what dose is it? How much did they take? How do you know they've eaten it? So I'm afraid we do tend to err on the supplement route. Not saying that's necessarily better, but it's certainly better for clinical trials to prove a point. And it's quite popular amongst patients. This is a study we presented in Adelaide earlier this year, where we looked at people's supplement intake. And interestingly, that 20% of our patients, it was a survey of 350 patients, 20% took supplements if they didn't have a symptom. But if they had a symptom, such as a hot flush or joint pain, up to 80% of patients went to the chemist and bought some supplements. I'm not going to talk about the whole review of supplements. I'm just going to talk about whole food supplements. So this is basically concentrated food rather than removing a chemical such as a vitamin and putting it into a pill. So that's a completely different topic which we haven't got time to go into today. I was lucky enough to be invited to this committee, the Complementary Therapies and Lifestyle Clinical Trials Committee, and which is now disbanded. So there was so much criticism that the health profession would dare start designing studies relating to complementary therapy that it was eventually closed down, which is a shame. But I was fortunately in this couple of years while it was going. And one of the things we did is look at whole foods and look at the data for phase 2 studies, animal studies, cell line studies, and some randomized studies to see which foods probably had the biggest impact on cancer. And there's lots. I mean, there's a league table of about 50 or 60, but we came down to these four, which is green tea, curcumin, pomegranate, and broccoli, because they all have their sort of anti-cancer properties in different ways. Some act as antioxidants, some change the genetic signature of tumour cells by promoting genes which fight cancer and suppressing genes which promote it. Others stop stem cell promotion. So we felt that if we had foods from different sources with different mechanisms of action, there'd be a synergistic effect. And then we looked for a tumour type to experiment on, to do a double-blind randomised trial where 100 people would have a supplement containing those foods and some other ones would have a placebo. And obviously it had to be made to a very high standard where there was very little pesticides, there was authenticity checked, and even we had to do mass spectrometry to make sure there was no contaminants or any meddling, which has happened in the past. And it became known as the POMI-T trial and the POMI-T supplement. And it showed a very profound effect on PSA progression in men with prostate cancer. We picked prostate cancer initially because this is a good group to practice on because there's a, not a good word practice, but research, I mean. So because you've got a large group of men with prostate who don't need intervention. They maybe have a PSA relapse after radiotherapy or they've got low-grade tumour. So you can wait for a while and only then treat the people who've progressed. So it's a way of filtering out the ones who need treatment and not. So the majority of people who took POMET in the study did not progress, so they didn't need radiotherapy or surgery. And there's many more people have gone on, and this has been substantiated in further trials. What is nice about this study, it was a government-backed study, it was non-commercial, it was audited through the National Health and all the appropriate channels. And we were invited, there was 10 talks for ASCO, which is the world's biggest cancer conference, and we were invited to be one of those for that year for prostate cancer. Now, that's not showing off, but what it is trying to emphasise is if you do the right trials of complementary therapies, they will be put on the stage. You know, it's mainly because a lot of the trials aren't well conducted or they're not audited properly. But if you do a proper study, it is given the platform, and doctors were interested in it. And it was published in a very reputable journal. And we went on to show that it had a direct effect on actual tumour size as well, where we did an MRI study afterwards. So it wasn't just a PSA effect, there was actually a tumour effect. And more interestingly, that Jack Chuzek, who's a very eminent scientist from St. Bartholomew's, is now going to do a further trial of POMET, aspirin and vitamin D against placebo. So that's about to start. So the other area we're interested in is arthralgia. The other part of the study we presented in Adelaide in the Mass Conference was recording patients' actual symptoms, the real-life symptoms. According to the published literature from the drug companies, there's an incidence of arthralgia on hormones of about 17%. When you actually ask people, it's about 55%. It's a lot worse than you think. And another study we presented in the NCRI conference in Liverpool last year asked patients why they weren't exercising. Now, some of them just didn't want to, but a lot of them weren't exercising because they found it uncomfortable. They were worried that their fatigue would get worse, and they actually had arthritis. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy here. We're inducing arthritis by giving them hormones, telling them to exercise, but say, I can't exercise because I've got arthritis. So we've then started doing some work with this group, and we said, well, what nutraceuticals are the best things for arthritis, because this is chondroitin and all those, and they said, well, there's not a lot of evidence. Most of the emerging evidence is from whole polyphenol-rich foods, so mushrooms, herbs and spices. So we thought, well, why don't we design a study? So when we give people hormones where we know 55% are going to get arthritis, why don't we give them a nutraceutical at that point to see if it prevents arthritis and at the same time encourage them to exercise and see if it actually allows them to exercise more? So that's exactly what we've just started doing. We're using some of the ingredients of POMET, but we're adding in some mushroom, put some pepper in, and we're actually using some frankincense as well. So it's a new sort of group of chemicals. And we're excited about the endpoints of this because we're not only going to look at arthritis levels, but how much exercise they're doing, because we believe that we can get a difference in the exercise levels between the two groups. And then if we can exercise more, we'll have all the other benefits of exercise, reducing peripheral neuropathy, weight gain, hot flushes, and psychological morbidity. We're doing some other studies on using phytochemical-rich creams to try and stop this happening when we give chemotherapy, which is a distressing side effect which has been largely overlooked. And that's just finished. We've just finished recruiting that, and we're going to publish that next year to see if applying a cream to the nail bed would reduce the incidence of onycholysis by acting as a local antidote. I'll just finish off with some case reports. Obviously we do go by randomised trials, etc., but at the end of the day, the patients I see and look in the eye are the ones I get, you get satisfaction by giving chemotherapy. I actually get more satisfaction the patients coming back when I haven't given them anything, and this is the type of thing happening. This was a guy, he was on TV actually, the broccoli soup man. Has anyone heard of the broccoli? Yeah. So he'd progressed on chemotherapy, he progressed on maximum androgen blockade, he'd had two lots of radiotherapy, median survival 4 months, okay? So he developed his PSA was going up, and he developed some lymph nodes and things there. His wife started making him broccoli soup every day, and he did later start taking the supplement, but it was really the broccoli soup which did it. A year later, node smaller, PSA dropped. Last year, well, it's still now, actually. So that was that. That's 8 years later. On a median survival of 4 months with no change in the medical treatment. I have to add that. A lot of these cases, because they've added something and not told you. No disease, PSA 0.2. Very remarkable. I mean, of course, not all my patients with metastatic prostate cancer do this on broccoli soup, otherwise I'd be out of a job, of course. It's probably a small proportion. But, you know, for him, fantastic. Another woman, She had bowel cancer, she relapsed in her liver, lymph nodes in her abdomen and lung. She was inoperable, but you can still operate on some metastases and be cured. She joined a gym, she's cut out all sugar, she reduced all processed meat, she virtually went vegetarian, but good quality, not all organic. She reduced her carcinogen, she took supplements, and she massively increased her polyphenol intake. Over 2 years later, again, without any chemotherapy, tumour smaller. Again, I emphasise that some people do this and they don't get a response, but you get that with any treatment, don't you? You don't get a response in some patients with chemotherapy. So in some patients, these, not dramatic, I mean, they enjoy this lifestyle most of the time, they feel better, but you can have dramatic, this is another guy. And then I was actually interviewed by Sky recently and said, well, you're just talking about people with low volume, low grade cancers. Of course, you're going to get a change with lifestyle in these. Well, this is a lady with brain metastases. So this isn't low volume, non-aggressive disease. And this is actually 2 years now. This has gone on. She had no change in her hormone therapy. She'd had lung mets about a year before and she was given hormones. And then a year later, she came back after a fit. We did a scan and it showed metastases. I said, well, you really should have whole brain radiotherapy and chemotherapy. She said, well, you know, I'm fine. I've got anti-fit medication, so I'm not fitting. I'll just see how it goes with some extreme lifestyle changes. She smoked. She stopped smoking. She did all those things I've just talked about. 2 years later, absolutely no progression of her brain mets. Absolutely remarkable. So it shows that these things can work. Not on everyone, but they can work. So that's the end. I hope I haven't gone over for Liz, who's going to talk about another very important. We have questions afterwards on the stand, so probably should we just do that? Yeah. The blog, if you want some practical things, is based on from that website. And the reason why I put this is not to promote Pommy Tea, it's just that my research manager always gets about 50 phone calls after these talks. So it's got its own website, so you can, any questions, you can refer to that rather than ringing her up. Thank you very much.
Okay, on now to our other speaker, Liz Butler. Liz Butler is a well-known nutritionist who spent her working career working with cancer particularly. She was the lead nutritionist at the Penny Brown Centre for 7 years. She's also been a consultant to several major cancer charities in the UK. She's now set up on her own with Body Soul Nutrition with two other nutritionists. All three are here today. They, again, will be on the stand afterwards to answer questions. But today, Liz is going to be particularly talking about the whole mental, spiritual, psychological side of things and how important it can be to support that side of things at the same time as everything else. So over to Liz. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. So as we don't have a huge amount of time, I'm just going to put up a slide a bit about Body Soul Nutrition. As Robin said, there's a team of three nutritional therapists, Catherine and Sarah, are here today with me. So you can have a look at that while I start speaking. So yes, I'm a nutritional therapist and I've spent 17 years providing nutritional support to people with cancer. And yet I'm here today speaking not about the value of diet and foods, about the importance of taking care of the mind and soul. So why is this? Well, first of all, because Robert's done an amazing job presenting the argument that dietary changes are very important in cancer. But also, I've now worked with many hundreds of people with cancer, and what I've seen is that no matter how spot on the nutritional support is, if the mind and the soul are not given equal attention, then there's really only so much that can be achieved. And so several years ago, I developed what I call the seven elements of healing, which covers all the aspects that I've observed to be important in maximizing healing potential with cancer. Its aim being to nourish individuals on the level of the body, the mind, and the soul. So you can see from this, we've got nutrition, detoxification, physical activity and movement, rest and relaxation, bioenergetic balance, and that's about looking at the energies in our external environment and within the internal body and how they impact on physical health, and then emotional well-being and deeper connection. Deeper connection really relating to how we care for the soul. and I might have time to talk a bit more about that later. So none of these elements are more important than one another. There may be individuals for whom addressing one or more of these is more pressing, but they all require attention because their actions are synergistic. When all of the elements are being taken care of, then the overall health-inducing effects become greater than the sum of each element alone. And this is when the magic happens. This is when those rainbow colours merge to form white healing light. So, as I said, in this short talk, I'm going to be focusing mainly on the sixth element, which is emotional well-being, and how this nourishes us on the level of the mind. So we know from the research literature that negative thinking and a pessimistic outlook has a detrimental effect on health. And specifically in relation to cancer, there are a number of studies that highlight this association, and I've put a few here. So first of all, women diagnosed with breast or gynecological cancer who had high levels of pessimism were shown to be at greater risk for anxiety and depression. Another study showed that breast cancer survivors who exhibited a pessimistic explanatory style or had a pessimistic outlook reported lower physical health-related quality of life, and not just immediately after their diagnosis, but for years after their diagnosis, compared to those women who had a non-pessimistic outlook. So negative thinking affects us psychologically, it affects us physically, and we can see also from this last study that it has a direct impact on survival. So this study showed that pessimistic explanatory style was found to be prognostic for poor lung cancer survival. But it's all very well knowing this, and most people are very well aware that attitude plays a role in our health, but actually switching to a more positive outlook can be difficult. And I don't know if you've ever tried to have positive thoughts when you've been hurting emotionally inside. I mean, how did you get on with that? It doesn't really work very well, does it? And so it's necessary for the person with cancer, or indeed anyone wanting a more authentic, positive view of life, to go deeper and to explore what's preventing them from accessing their natural state of joy. Almost always, it's emotional wounds and traumas that are blocking a person's inherent joyfulness. And when we talk about these wounds or traumas, we're talking about an event that happened at some point, usually in childhood and very often in the early years between 0 and 7, an event that happened that was too disturbing at the time to be processed. And as I said, often these events occur in early childhood, and often they can be quite major events. So scientists have discovered that certain events occurring in childhood that they've termed adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, including parents divorcing, sexual, emotional, physical abuse, and neglect, can cause long-term trauma leading to psychological and physical damage, including increasing the risk of cancer. But it's not necessarily always major events. You know, this is quite a subjective thing. Some people will become disturbed and even traumatized from seemingly quite minor events. But when we have an event like this that we don't process properly, then it's shunted into our psychological and our physiological memory. And scientists are now discovering that we hold these memories not just in the neurons in the brain, but in the cells throughout our whole body. And the physical injury that occurs when we hold on to emotional pain, when we don't process these feelings, seems to be a result of ongoing chronic stress on the body. And we all know that chronic stress can be very damaging to us physically. So here's just a few of the physical impacts of chronic stress with particular relationship to cancer. So chronic stress will deplete our nutrients, particularly vitamin C, which is an antioxidant, so that may lead to increased DNA mutation. Chronic stress will disturb our blood sugar levels and lead to high insulin, which will create inflammation in the body. Chronic stress will imbalance the levels of our estrogen and progesterone, leading to estrogen dominance, which is a risk factor for certain cancers. And chronic stress will also upset the functioning of our thyroid gland, and underactive thyroid is also can increase the risk of certain cancers. Chronic stress will also deplete the hormone melatonin, and melatonin is one of our very important defences against cancer. Chronic stress will also decrease the effectiveness of cortisol to regulate inflammation. So again, we have increased inflammation. And we also know that chronic stress will disturb and dysregulate our immune system as a whole. So we all know that chronic stress can be very damaging to us physically, as I've said. And I keep talking about these traumas and wounds being as a result of unprocessed emotions. So what do I mean by unprocessed? Well, what I mean is that the emotions have not been fully felt and expressed. As that famous saying goes, you can't heal what you don't feel. And there's now a significant amount of research showing that when we don't feel or express our emotions, there are negative consequences for our health. So diminished emotional expressiveness has been linked to a range of health risks, and these risks are associated with that chronic stress and include cortisol disruption and immune disturbance. Particularly in relation to cancer, research has linked repression and suppression of emotions with faster cancer progression and shorter survival. Now, repression is a defense mechanism when a person is unable to remember or is even cognitively aware of their emotional traumas or pain. So this is when we're burying them to quite a deep level, whereas suppression is when the person is aware of those emotions but just doesn't allow themselves to feel or express them. So with cancer, there may be possibly a particular association with anger. And a study found that extreme suppression of anger was the most commonly identified characteristic of 160 breast cancer patients who were given a detailed psychological interview and self-administered questionnaire. So we're beginning to see how vital it is for us to feel and express our emotions if we want to reduce the risk of cancer, and also how important it is for the person already diagnosed if they want to support their well-being and maximise their recovery potential. But many people are resistant to this idea, which is perfectly understandable, because coming face-to-face with our emotional pain is, of course, not easy. However, and the good news is, processing painful emotions doesn't have to be as grueling as we might imagine. Now, the traditional form of processing difficult emotions has been through the talking therapies such as psychotherapy and counselling. And these therapies prove to be absolutely invaluable to many, many people, many of the clients that I see. But I do just want to say at this point that it isn't actually necessary to dig around and analyse over and over why we feel the way we do. The only thing that matters is what we are feeling now. The whys, the wherefores, and the underlying story are less important, and some would say completely irrelevant. And I think at this point, it's important and helpful to think about what emotions actually are. We don't really think very often about what emotions actually are, so I think it's good for us to consider that. So emotions are energy. They are energy in motion. And like all energy, it's in their nature to constantly move and transform. They need to flow. Now, when that flow is stopped, because the emotions are not fully felt, that's when the trouble starts. But if we start to allow and fully feel those old emotional wounds, then amazing healing can happen. Now, also, emotions are our most important guidance system. They let us know when we're aligned with the deepest desires, with our desires of our higher consciousness, and when we are not. And if we're sensible, we will listen to our emotions and we will let them guide us in this way. If a particular emotion rises up over and over again, and it will until we take notice, then we need to bring those emotions into full awareness and to feel them deeply so that they can be allowed to flow once more. And there's some good research that shows how healing emotional expression can be for people with cancer. So in terms of the talking therapies and psychological intervention, a recent systematic review showed that this type of therapy enhances cancer survival time. And a specific study found a doubling of survival rate in women who were having group therapy who were able to openly express their anger compared to women who were in the same group who were not able to express and they actually constrained their anger. As well as the talking therapies, there have been many other studies showing that art, drama, dance, music and writing therapies all have great benefits to people with cancer, improving quality of life and other benefits too. So feeling and expressing by whatever means is very healing and very supportive to people with cancer. And so I've laid out what I feel are four simple steps that will take someone on a journey of allowing and processing their challenging emotions. The first step is to listen to your emotions, recognize them as messages, and trust that they are here to serve you. Secondly, receive your emotions from a place of non-judgment and self-acceptance. There are no good emotions and bad emotions, no positive emotions and no negative emotions. All emotions are here in our life for a reason and they're here to guide us, so we shouldn't judge them as good or bad. The next step is to embrace your emotions and allow yourself to feel them fully. This will enable emotions to flow naturally and dissipate. And I think many of us are aware of how this works. If we're feeling upset and then we allow ourselves to have a good cry and just to let that emotion overwhelm our body, then we can feel that that emotion then starts to dissipate. And then finally, once the challenging emotion has passed, and it doesn't mean it's gone forever, but in that moment it has gone, then we need to focus our attention on the things that make us feel good, to milk that good feeling moment. Now, obviously, it sounds simple when I lay it out like this, but stage three, where we get into feeling our emotions, can be challenging and very difficult. But there are some amazing processes and therapies out there that can really help with this step. And the one that I really like, and I don't know if any of you know about the journey, is the journey technique. As the organisation describe the journey, they say on their website that it's a globally recognised and critically acclaimed healing and transformational modality to uncover and awaken your limitless potential and to apply it in every area of your life. It doesn't really say exactly what it does, but Brandon Bays, who developed the journey, had a large tumour herself. She was already a healer at the time that she developed this tumour. And she developed a technique after using it with herself that involves going deep into the emotion. She actually took a few days out to really isolate herself and work with this. She went deep into her emotions and found that as she went into each one, they transformed and led her into to a new emotion, and she finally worked through all of that until she got to a place of peace and her tumour shrunk away. Now, there are now journey practitioners all over the world helping people to process and feel their emotions in this way, and we have a journey practitioner as one of our associated health professionals at Body Soul Nutrition, and I've seen some really powerful effects in our clients. So there is a caution with all of this, because you can do this work alone, but if you start to uncover emotions, I mean, if there have been events and traumas in early life that bring up very difficult emotions, then doing this sort of processing alone is not always recommended. So if that is the case, then it's very important to get support. So finally, I'm going to leave you with this quote from Bernie Siegel, who is... If I don't know if any of you know him, but he is one of the absolute pioneers of body-mind medicine. He's spent many years working in this field and has a particular interest in cancer. So he says, "I've collected 57 extremely well-documented so-called cancer miracles. At a certain particular moment in time, they decided that the anger and the depression were probably not the best way to go since they had such little time left. And so they went from being that to being loving, caring, no longer angry, no longer depressed, and able to talk to the people they loved. These 57 people had the same pattern. They gave up totally their anger and they gave up totally their depression by specifically a decision to do so. And at that point, the tumours started to shrink." Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, there we are, two fantastic speakers. Stand number 1904, the Yes to Life stand, is where they will both be after this to answer any of your questions, so do come along. As I said, do take a listen to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio on the internet. You'll hear an interview there with Brandon Bayes and with Professor Thomas and with Liz Butler during the last few months. I'd like to just mention upcoming events for Yes to Life. There are two workshops coming up, one in Bristol, which is on food, and one in London, which is on exercise. Do look those up if you're interested. And then on November the 19th, we've got our annual flagship conference, which is about cancer as a metabolic epigenetic disease. So we're going to have some international speakers. Really important event that should be. So do come along. So finally, I'd just like you all to give another thank you, please, to our speakers, Professor Thomas and Liz Butler.
There are few things more heartening to me than to hear an oncologist talking with such understanding of and support for lifestyle interventions for cancer. Roll on the day when most oncologists in the UK think the same way. And it's great to hear Liz Butler's understanding and experience of the psychological and emotional challenges of cancer, gained over many, many years. Resources for today's show are on the Yes to Life website. Go to yestolife.org.uk, click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar, and then choose UK Health Radio. Included in the resources are the speaker slides for both talks. The exercise workshop in London that I mentioned has at this point already happened, but the Bristol Outsmart Cancer Cookery class on the 15th of October is still to come, as is the London Annual Conference on November the 19th. Author Travis Christofferson is our keynote speaker. He'll be introducing a day of exploring the very basics of cancer, what it is and how it develops, which naturally leads on to how we should treat it. Next week, I shall be exploring a popular supportive complementary therapy, reflexology, and what it has to offer for those with cancer. I hope you'll be able to join me again. Goodbye.